He's a slave, but he may have the spirit of a free man. He's a slave. But is that really to count against him? Show me a man who isn't a slave. One is a slave to sex, another to money, another to ambition. All are slaves to hope or fear. I could show you a man who has been a consul, who is a slave to his little old woman. A millionaire who is the slave of a little girl in domestic service. I could show you some highly aristocratic young men who are utter slaves to stage artists. And there's no state of slavery more disgraceful than one which is self-imposed. So you needn't allow yourself to be deterred by the snobbish people I've been talking about from showing good humour towards your slaves instead of adopting an attitude of arrogant superiority towards them. Have them respect you rather than fear you. Here, just because I've said they should respect a master rather than fear him, someone will tell us that I'm now inviting slaves to proclaim their freedom and bringing about their employer's overthrow. Are slaves to pay their respects, like dependent followers or early morning callers? That's what he means, I suppose. Well, anyone saying this forgets that what is enough for a god in the shape of worship cannot be too little for a master. To be really respected is to be loved, and love and fear will not mix. That's why I think you're absolutely right in not wishing to be feared by your slaves, and in confining your lashings to verbal ones. As instruments of correction, beatings are for animals only. Besides, what annoys us does not necessarily do us any harm, but we masters are apt to be robbed of our senses by mere passing fancies, to the point where our anger is called out by anything which fails to answer to our will. We assume the mental attitudes of tyrants, for they, too, forget their own strength and the helplessness of others, and grow white-hot with fury, as if they had received an injury, when all the time they are quite immune from any such danger through the sheer exaltedness of their position. Nor, indeed, are they unaware of this, but it does not stop them seizing an opportunity of finding fault with an inferior and maltreating him for it. They receive an injury by way of excuse to do one themselves. But I won't keep you any longer. You don't need exhortation. It is a mark of a good way of life that, among other things, it satisfies and abides. Bad behaviour, constantly changing, not for the better, simply into different forms, has none of this stability. Letter number 48. I shall reply later to the letter you sent me while you were on your journey. It was as long as the journey itself. I must first take myself aside and deliberate what advice I should give. For you yourself, before consulting me as you are doing, gave long thought to the question whether you should consult me at all, so I ought to be giving this question of advice far longer thought, on the principle that it takes you more time to solve a problem than to set it, particularly when one course is to your interest and another to mine. Or does this make me sound like an Epicurean again? No, if a thing is in your interest, it is also in my own interest. Otherwise, if any matter that affects you is no concern of mine, I am not a friend. Friendship creates a community of interest between us in everything. We have neither successes nor setbacks as individuals. Our lives have a common end. No one can lead a happy life if he thinks only of himself and turns everything to his own purposes. You should live for the other person, if you wish to live for yourself. The assiduous and scrupulous cultivation of this bond, which leads to our associating with our fellow men, and believes in the existence of a common law for all mankind, contributes more than anything else to the maintenance of that more intimate bond I was mentioning, friendship. A person who shares much with a fellow human being will share everything with a friend. What I should like those subtle thinkers, you know the ones I mean, my peerless Lucilius, to teach me is this, what my duties are to a friend and to a man, rather than the number of senses in which the expression friend is used, and how many different meanings the word man has. Before my very eyes, wisdom and folly are taking their separate stands. Which shall I join? Whose side am I to follow? For one person, man is equivalent to friend. For another, man and friend are far from being identified, and in making a friend, one man will be seeking an asset, while another will be making himself an asset to the other. And in the midst of all this, what you people do for me is pull words about and cut up syllables. One is led to believe that unless one has constructed syllogisms of the craftiest kind, and reduced fallacies to a compact form in which a false conclusion is derived from a true premise, one will not be in a position to distinguish what one should aim at and what one should avoid. It makes one ashamed that men of our advanced years should turn a thing as serious as this into a game. Mouse is a syllable, and a mouse nibbles cheese. Therefore, a syllable nibbles cheese. Suppose for the moment I can't detect the fallacy in that. What danger am I placed in by such lack of insight? What serious consequences are there in it for me? What I have to fear, no doubt, is the possibility, one of these days, of catching my syllable in a mousetrap, or even having my cheese eaten up by a book, if I'm not careful. Unless perhaps the following train of logic is a more acute one. Mouse is a syllable, and a syllable does not nibble cheese. Therefore, a mouse does not nibble cheese. What childish fatuities these are! Is this what we philosophers acquire wrinkles in our brows for? Is this what we let our beards grow long for? Is this what we teach with faces grave and pale? Shall I tell you what philosophy holds out to humanity? Counsel. One person is facing death, another is vexed by poverty, while another is tormented by wealth, whether his own or someone else's. One man is appalled by his misfortunes, while another longs to get away from his own prosperity. One man is suffering at the hands of men, another at the hands of the gods. What's the point of concocting whimsies for me of the sort I've just been mentioning? This isn't the place for fun. You're called in to help the unhappy. You're pledged to bring succour to the shipwrecked, to those in captivity, to the sick, the needy, and men who are just placing their heads beneath the executioner's uplifted axe. Where are you off to? What are you about? The person you're engaging in wordplay with is in fear. Go to his aid. All mankind are stretching out their hands to you on every side. Lives that have been ruined, lives that are on their way to ruin, are appealing for some help. It is to you that they look for hope and assistance. They are begging you to extricate them from this awful vortex, to show them in their doubt and disarray the shining torch of truth. Tell them what nature has made necessary and what she has made superfluous. Tell them how simple are the laws she has laid down, and how straightforward and enjoyable life is for those who follow them, and how confused and disagreeable it is for others who put more trust in popular ideas than they do in nature. All right, if you can point out to me where those puzzles are likely to bring such people relief. Which of them removes cravings or brings them under control? If only they were simply unhelpful, they're actually harmful. I'll give you the clearest proof, whenever you like, of their tendency to weaken and enfeeble even eminent talents once applied to such quibbles. And when it comes to saying how they equip people proposing to do battle with fortune, and what weapons they offer them, one hangs one's head with shame. Is this the way to our supreme ideal? Do we get there by means of all that if X, Y, or if not Y, Z, one finds in philosophy? And by means of quibbles that would be shameful and discreditable, even among persons occupying themselves with law reports? When you're leading the person you're questioning into a trap, aren't you just making it look as if he has lost his case on a purely technical point of pleading? The praetor's court, however, restores litigants, losing in this way, to their rightful position, and philosophy does the same for the people thus questioned. Why do philosophers like you abandon the magnificent promises you have made? After assuring me in solemn terms that you will see to it that my eyes shall no more be overwhelmed by the glitter of gold than by the glitter of a sword, that I shall spurn with magnificent strength of purpose the things all other men pray for, and the things all other men are afraid of. Why do you have to descend to the schoolroom ABC? What do you say? Is this the way to the heavens? for that is what philosophy has promised me, that she will make me God's equal. That's the invitation, and that's what I've come for. Be as good as your word. Keep clear, then, my dear Lucilius, as far as you can, of the sort of quibbles and qualifications I've been mentioning in philosophers. Straightforwardness and simplicity are in keeping with goodness. Even if you had a large part of your life remaining before you, you would have to organize it very economically to have enough for all the things that are necessary. As things are, isn't it the height of folly to learn inessential things when time's so desperately short? Letter number 53. I wonder whether there's anything I couldn't be persuaded into now, after letting myself be persuaded recently into taking a trip by sea. The sea was quite calm when we cast off. The sky was certainly heavily overcast, with the kind of dark clouds that generally break in a squall or downpour, but in spite of the uncertain, threatening skies, I thought it would be perfectly feasible to make it across the few miles from your Parthenope over to Puteoli. And so, with the object of getting the crossing over quicker, I headed straight for Nisus over the open water to cut out all the intervening curves of the coastline. Now, when I had got so far across that it made no odds whether I went on or turned back, first of all the smoothness which had tempted me to my undoing disappeared. There was no storm as yet, but a heavy swell was running by then, and the waves were steadily getting rougher. I began by asking the helmsman to put me ashore somewhere. He kept saying the coast was a rugged one, without a haven anywhere, and that there was nothing to be feared quite so much in a storm as a lee shore. I was in far too bad a way, though, for any thought of possible danger to enter my head, as I was suffering the torments of that sluggish brand of seasickness that will not bring one relief, the kind that upsets the stomach without clearing it. So I put pressure on him, and compelled him, willy-nilly, to make for the shore. Once we were close in, there was no waiting on my part for anything to be done in the manner commended by Virgil. Bows faced seawards, or anchor cast from bow. Remembering my training as a long-standing devotee of cold baths, I dived into the sea in just the way the cold water addict ought to, in my woolly clothes. You can imagine what I suffered as I crawled out over the rocks, as I searched for a route to safety, or fought my way there. It made me realize how right sailors are in being afraid of a lee shore. What I endured in my inability to endure my then self is beyond belief. You can take it from me that the reason Ulysses got himself wrecked everywhere was not so much because Neptune was against him from the day he was born, but because he was given to seasickness, like me. It'll take me 20 years to reach my destination, too, if I ever have to journey anywhere by sea. As soon as I settled my stomach, for stomachs, as you know, aren't clear of seasickness the moment they're clear of the sea, and rubbed myself over with the imprecation to put some life back into my body, I began to reflect how we are attended by an appalling forgetfulness of our weaknesses, even the physical ones, which are continually bringing themselves to our notice, and much more so with those that are not only more serious, but correspondingly less apparent. A slight feverishness may deceive a person, but when it has developed to the point where a genuine fever is raging, it will extract an admission that something is wrong from even a tough and hardened individual. Suppose our feet ache with little needling pains in the joints. At this stage, we pass it off and say we've sprained an ankle or strained something in some exercise or other. While the disorder is in its indeterminate commencing phase, its name eludes us. But when it starts bending the feet in just the way an ankle rack does, it makes them both misshapen, we have to confess that we've got the gout. With afflictions of the spirit, though, the opposite is the case. The worse a person is, the less he feels it. You needn't feel surprised, my dearest Lucilius. A person sleeping lightly perceives impressions in his dreams and is sometimes even aware during sleep that he is asleep, whereas a heavy slumber blots out even dreams and plunges the mind too deep for consciousness of self. Why does no one admit his failings? Because he's still deep in them. It's the person who's awakened who recounts his dream, and acknowledging one's failings is a sign of health. So let us rouse ourselves, so that we may be able to demonstrate our errors. But only philosophy will wake us. Only philosophy will shake us out of that heavy sleep. Devote yourself entirely to her. You're worthy of her. She's worthy of you. Fall into each other's arms. Say a firm, plain no to every other occupation. There's no excuse for your pursuing philosophy merely in moments when occasion allows. If you were sick, you would take a rest from attending to your personal affairs and drop your practice in the courts. And during a spell of improvement in your condition, you wouldn't look on any client as being so important that you'd undertake his case in court. No, you'd devote your entire attention to recovering from your illness in the quickest possible time. Well, then, aren't you going to do the same in these circumstances? Away with every obstacle, and leave yourself free to acquire a sound mind. No one ever attains this if he's busy with other things. Philosophy wields an authority of her own. She doesn't just accept time, she grants one it. She's not something one takes up in odd moments. She's an active, full-time mistress, ever-present and demanding. When some state or other offered Alexander a part of its territory and half of all its property, he told them that he hadn't come to Asia with the intention of accepting whatever they cared to give him, but letting them keep whatever he chose to leave them. Philosophy likewise tells all other occupations, "It's not my intention to accept whatever time is left over from you. You shall have instead what I reject." Give your whole mind to her. Sit at her side and pay her constant court, and an enormous gap will widen between yourself and other men. You'll end up far in advance of all mankind, and not far behind the gods themselves. Would you like to know what actual difference between yourself and the gods will be? They will exist for longer. And yet to me, what an indisputable mark it is of a great artist to have captured everything in a tiny compass. A wise man has as much scope before him as a god with all eternity in front of him. There is one thing, too, in which the wise man actually surpasses any god. A god has nature to thank for his immunity from fear, while the wise man can thank his own efforts for this. Look at that for an achievement, to have all the frailty of a human being and all the freedom from care of a god. Philosophy's power to blunt all the blows of circumstances beyond belief. Never a missile lodges in her. She has strong, impenetrable defences. Some blows she breaks the force of, parrying them with the slack of her gown as if they were trivial. Others she flings off and hurls back at the centre. Letter number 54. Ill health, which had granted me quite a long spell of leave, has attacked me without warning again. What kind of ill health, you'll be asking? And well you may, for there isn't a single kind I haven't experienced. There's one particular ailment, though, for which I've always been singled out, so to speak. I see no reason why I should call it by its Greek name, difficulty in breathing being a perfectly good way of describing it. Its onslaught is of very brief duration. Like a squall, it is generally over within the hour. One could hardly, after all, expect anyone to keep on drawing his last breath for long, could one? I've been visited by all the troublesome or dangerous complaints there are, and none of them, in my opinion, is more unpleasant than this one. Which is hardly surprising, is it, when you consider that with anything else you're merely ill, while with this one you're constantly at your last gasp? This is why doctors have nicknamed it rehearsing death, since sooner or later the breath does just what it has been trying to do all those times. Do you imagine that as I write this, I must be feeling in high spirits, having escaped this time? No, It would be just as absurd for me to feel overjoyed at its being over, as if this meant I was a healthy man again, as it would be for a person to think he has won his case on obtaining an extension of time before trial. Even as I fought for breath, though, I never ceased to find comfort in cheerful and courageous reflections. "What's this?" I said. "So, death is having all these tries at me, is he? Let him, then. I had a try at him a long while ago myself." "When was this?" you'll say. "Before I was born. Death is just not being. What that is like, I know already. It will be the same after me as it was before me. If there is any torment in the later state, there must also have been torment in the period before we saw the light of day, yet we never felt conscious of any distress then. I ask you, wouldn't you say that anyone who took the view that a lamp was worse off when it was put out than it was before it was lit was an utter idiot? We, too, are lit and put out. We suffer somewhat in the intervening period, but at either end of it there is a deep tranquillity. For unless I'm mistaken, we are wrong, my dear Lucilius, in holding that death follows after, when in fact it precedes us as well as succeeds. Death is all that was before us. What does it matter, after all, whether you cease to be or never begin, when the result of either is that you do not exist?" I kept on talking to myself in these and similar terms, silently, needless to say, words being out of the question. Then, little by little, the affliction and my breathing, which was coming to be little more than a panting now, came on at longer intervals and slackened away. It has lasted on all the same, and in spite of the passing of this attack, my breathing is not yet coming naturally. I feel a sort of catch and hesitation in it. Let it do as it pleases, though, so long as the sighs aren't heartfelt. You can feel assured on my score of this. I shall not be afraid when the last hour comes. I'm already prepared, not planning as much as a day ahead. The man, though, whom you should admire and imitate, is the one who finds it a joy to live, and in spite of that is not reluctant to die. For where's the virtue in going out when you're really being thrown out? And yet there is this virtue about my case. I'm in the process of being thrown out, certainly, but in the manner of it, it is as if I were going out, and the reason why it never happens to a wise man is that being thrown out signifies expulsion from a place one is reluctant to depart from, and there is nothing the wise man does reluctantly. He escapes necessity because he wills what necessity is going to force on him.
Letter number 55. I've just this moment returned from a ride in my sedan chair, feeling as tired as if I'd walked the whole distance, instead of being seated all the way. Even to be carried for any length of time is hard work, and all the more so, I dare say, because it is unnatural, nature having given us legs with which to do our walking, just as she gave us eyes with which to do our own seeing. Soft living imposes on us the penalty of debility. We cease to be able to do the things we've long been grudging about doing. However, I was needing to give my body a shaking up, either to dislodge some phlegm, perhaps, that had collected in my throat, or to have some thickness, due to one cause or another, in my actual breathing reduced by the motion, which I've noticed before has done me some good. So I deliberately continued the ride for quite a long way, with the beach itself tempting me onwards. It sweeps round between Kumai and Servilius Vatia's country house, in a sort of narrow causeway with the sea on one side and a lagoon on the other. A recent storm had left it firm, for, as you know, a fast-running heavy surf makes a beach flat and smooth, while a longish period of calm weather leads to a disintegration of this surface with the disappearance of the moisture that binds the particles of sand together. I had started looking around me in my usual way to see whether I could find anything I could turn to good account, when my eyes turned to the house which had once belonged to Vatia. This was the place where Vatia passed the latter part of his life, a wealthy man who had held the office of praetor, but was famed for nothing but his life of retirement, and considered a fortunate man on that ground alone. for whenever a man was ruined through being a friend of Asinius Gallus, or an enemy of Sejanus, or devoted to Sejanus, for it came to be as dangerous to have been a follower of his as it was to cross him, people used to exclaim, "Vatia, you're the only person who knows how to live." What in fact he knew was how to hide, rather than how to live. And there's a lot of difference between your life being a retiring one and its being a spineless one. I never used to pass this house while Vatia was alive without saying, "Here lieth Vatia." But philosophy, my dear Lucilius, is such a holy thing, and inspires so much respect, that even something that resembles it has a specious appeal. Let a man retire, and the common crowd will think of him as leading a life apart, free of all cares, self-contented, living for himself, when in fact not one of these blessings can be won by anyone other than the philosopher. He alone knows how to live for himself. He is the one, in fact, who knows the fundamental thing, how to live. The person who has run away from the world and his fellow men, whose exile is due to the unsuccessful outcome of his own desires, who is unable to endure the sight of others more fortunate, who has taken to some place of hiding in his alarm like a timid, inert animal, he is not living for himself, but for his belly and his sleep and his passions. In utter degradation, in other words. The fact that a person is living for nobody does not automatically mean that he is living for himself. Still, a persevering steadfastness of purpose counts for a lot, so that even inertia, if stubbornly maintained, may carry a certain weight. I can't give you any accurate information about the house itself. I only know the front of it and the parts in view, the parts that it displays, even to passers-by. There are two artificial grottos, considerable feats of engineering, each as big as the most spacious hall, one of them not letting in the sun at all, the other retaining it right up until its setting. There is a grove of plane trees, through the middle of which runs a stream flowing alternately like a tide race into the sea and into the Acherusian lake, a stream capable of supporting a stock of fish even if constantly exploited. It is left alone, though, when the sea is open. Only when bad weather gives the fishermen a holiday do they lay hands on this ready supply. But the most advantageous feature of the house is that it has Baiae next door. It enjoys all the amenities of that resort, and is free from its disadvantages. I can speak for these attractions from personal knowledge, and I am quite prepared to believe, too, that it is an all-the-year-round house, since it lies in the path of the western breeze, catching it to such an extent as to exclude Baiae from the benefit of it. Vatia seems to have been no fool in choosing this place as the one in which he would spend his retirement, sluggish and senile as that retirement had become. The place one's in, though, doesn't make any contribution to peace of mind. It's the spirit that makes everything agreeable to oneself. I've seen for myself people sunk in gloom in cheerful and delightful country houses, and people in completely secluded surroundings who looked as if they were run off their feet. So there is no reason why you should feel that you're not as much at rest in your mind as you might be, just because you're not here in Campania. Why aren't you, for that matter? Transmit your thoughts all the way here. There's nothing to stop you enjoying the company of absent friends as often as you like, too, and for as long as you like. This pleasure in their company, and there's no greater pleasure, is one we enjoy the more when we're absent from one another. For having our friends present makes us spoilt. As a result of our talking and walking and sitting together every now and then, and being separated, we haven't a thought for those we've just been seeing. One good reason, too, why we should endure the absence patiently, is the fact that every one of us is absent, to a great extent, from his friends, even when they are around. Count up in this connection first the night spent away from one another, then the different engagements that keep each one busy, then the time passed in the privacy of one's study, and in trips to the country, and you'll see that periods abroad don't deprive us of so very much. Possession of a friend should be with the spirit. The spirit's never absent. It sees daily, whoever it likes. So, share with me my studies, my meals, my walks. Life would be restricted indeed if there were any barrier to our imaginations. I see you, my dear Lucilius. I hear you at this very moment. I feel so very much with you that I wonder whether I shouldn't start writing you notes rather than letters. Letter number 56. I cannot for the life of me see that quiet is as necessary to a person who has shut himself away to do some studying as it is usually thought to be. Here am I with a babel of noise going on all about me. I have lodgings right over a public bathhouse. Now imagine to yourself every kind of sound that can make one weary of one's ears. When the strenuous types are doing their exercises, swinging weight-laden hands about, I hear the grunting as they toil away, or go through the motions of toiling away, at them, and the hissings and strident gasps every time they expel their pent-up breath. When my attention turns to a less active fellow, who is contenting himself with an ordinary, inexpensive massage, I hear the smack of a hand pummeling his shoulders, the sound varying according as it comes down flat or cupped. But if on top of this some ball player comes along and starts shouting out the score, that's the end. Then add someone starting up a brawl, and someone else caught thieving, and the man who likes the sound of his voice in the bath, and the people who leap into the pool with a tremendous splash. Apart from those whose voices are, if nothing else, natural, think of the hair remover, continually giving vent to his shrill and penetrating cry in order to advertise his presence, never silent unless it be while he is plucking someone's armpits and making a client yell for him. Then think of the various cries of the man selling drinks, and the one selling sausages, and the other selling pastries, and all the ones hawking for the catering shops, each publicising his wares with a distinctive cry of his own. You must be made of iron, you may say, or else hard of hearing, if your mind is unaffected by all this babel of discordant noises around you, when continual good morning greetings were enough to finish off the Stoic Chrysippus. But I swear I no more notice all this roar of noise than I do the sound of waves or falling water. Even if I am here told the story of a people on the Nile who moved their capital solely because they could not stand the thundering of a cataract. Voices, I think, are more inclined to distract one than general noise. Noise merely fills one's ears, battering away at them, while voices actually catch one's attention. Among the things which create a racket all around me, without distracting me at all, I include the carriages hurrying by in the street, the carpenter who works in the same block, a man in the neighbourhood who saws, and this fellow turning horns and flutes at the trickling fountain and emitting blasts instead of music. I still find an intermittent noise more irritating than a continuous one. But by now I have so steeled myself for all these things that I can even put up with the coxswain's strident tones as he gives his oarsmen the rhythm. For I force my mind to become self-absorbed and not let outside things distract it. There can be absolute bedlam without, so long as there is no commotion within, so long as fear and desire are not at loggerheads, so long as meanness and extravagance are not at odds and harassing each other. For what is the good of having silence throughout the neighbourhood if one's emotions are in turmoil? The peaceful stillness of the night had lulled the world to rest. This is incorrect. There is no such thing as peaceful stillness, except where reason has lulled it to rest. Night does not remove our worries. It brings them to the surface. All it gives us is a change of anxieties. For even when people are asleep, they have dreams as troubled as their days. The only true serenity is the one which represents the free development of a sound mind. Look at the man whose quest for sleep demands absolute quiet from his spacious house. To prevent any sound disturbing his ears, every one of his host of slaves preserves total silence, and those who come anywhere near him walk on tiptoe. Naturally enough, he tosses from side to side, trying to snatch some fitful sleep in between the spells of fretting, and complains of having heard sounds when he never heard them at all. And what do you suppose is the reason? His mind is in a ferment. It is this which needs to be set at peace. Here is the mutiny that needs to be suppressed. The fact that the body is lying down is no reason for supposing that the mind is at peace. Rest is sometimes far from restful. hence our need to be stimulated into general activity and kept occupied and busy with pursuits of the right nature whenever we are victims of the sort of idleness that wearies of itself. When great military commanders notice indiscipline among their men, they suppress it by giving them some work to do, mounting expeditions to keep them actively employed. People who are really busy never have enough time to become skittish, and there is nothing so certain as the fact that the harmful consequences of inactivity are dissipated by activity. We commonly give the impression that the reasons for our having gone into political retirement are our disgust with public life and our dissatisfaction with some uncongenial and unrewarding post. Yet every now and then ambition rears its head again in the retreat into which we were really driven by our apprehensions and our waning interests. For our ambition did not cease because it had been rooted out, but merely because it had tired, or become piqued, perhaps, at its lack of success. I would say the same about extravagant living, which appears on occasions to have left one, and then, when one has declared for the simple life, places temptation in the way. In the middle of one's programme of frugality, it sets out after pleasures which one has discarded, but not condemned, its pursuit of them, indeed, being all the more ardent the less one is aware of it. For when they are in the open, vices invariably take a more moderate form. Diseases, too, are on the way towards being cured when once they have broken out instead of being latent and made their presence felt. So it is with the love of money, the love of power, and the other maladies that affect the minds of men. You may be sure that it is when they abate and give every appearance of being cured that they are at their most dangerous. We give the impression of being in retirement and are nothing of the kind. For if we are genuine in this, if we have sounded the retreat and really turned away from the surface show, then, as I was saying a little while ago, nothing will distract us. Men and birds together in full chorus will never break into our thinking, when that thinking is good and has at last come to be of a sure and steady character. The temperament that starts at the sound of a voice, or chance noises in general, is an unstable one, and one that has yet to attain inward detachment. It has an element of uneasiness in it, and an element of the rooted fear that makes a man prey to anxiety, as in the description given by our Virgil. And I, who formerly would never flinch at flying spears or serried ranks of Greeks, am now alarmed by every breeze and roused by every sound to nervousness, in fear for this companion and this load alike. The earlier character here is the wise man, who knows no fear at the hurtling of missiles, or the clash of weapons against weapons in the close-packed ranks, or the thunderous noise of a city in destruction. The other, later one, has everything to learn. Fearing for his belongings, he pales at every noise. A single cry, whatever it is, prostrates him, being immediately taken for the yelling of the enemy. The slightest movement frightens him out of his life. His baggage makes him a coward. Pick out any one of your successful men, with all they trail or carry about with them, and you will have a picture of the man in fear for this companion and this load. You may be sure, then, that you are at last lulled to rest, when noise never reaches you, and when voices never shake you out of yourself, whether they be menacing or inviting, or just a meaningless hubbub of empty sound all round you. This is all very well, you may say, but isn't it sometimes a lot simpler just to keep away from the din? I concede that, and in fact it is the reason why I shall shortly be moving elsewhere. What I wanted was to give myself a test and some practice. Why should I need to suffer the torture any longer than I want to, when Ulysses found so easy a remedy for his companions, even against the Sirens? Letter number 63. I am very sorry to hear of your friend Flacker's death. Still, I would not have you grieve unduly over it. I can scarcely venture to demand that you should not grieve at all, and yet I am convinced that it is better that way. But who will ever be granted that strength of character, unless he be a man already lifted far out of fortune's reach? Even he will feel a twinge of pain when a thing like this happens, but only a twinge. As for us, We can be pardoned for having given way to tears, so long as they have not run down in excessive quantities, and we have checked them for ourselves. When one has lost a friend, one's eyes should be neither dry nor streaming. Tears, yes, there should be, but not lamentation. Can you find the rule I'm laying down a harsh one, when the greatest of Greek poets has restricted to a single day, no more, a person's right to cry, in the passage where he tells us that even Niobe remembered to eat? Would you like to know what lies behind extravagant weeping and wailing? In our tears we are trying to find means of proving that we feel the loss. We are not being governed by our grief, but parading it. No one ever goes into mourning for the benefit merely of himself. Oh, the miserable folly of it all, that there should be an element of ostentation in grief. Come now, you will be asking, are you saying that I should forget a person who has been a friend? Well, you are not proposing to keep him very long in your memory, if his memory is to last just as long as your grief. At any moment something or other will happen that will turn that long face of yours into a smiling one. I do not see very much time going by before the sense of loss is mitigated, and even the keenest sorrowing settled down. Your face will cease to be its present picture of sadness as soon as you take your eyes off yourself. At the moment you are keeping a watch on your grief, but even as you do, it is fading away, and the keener it is, the quicker it is in stopping. Let us see to it that the recollection of those we have lost becomes a pleasure to us. Nobody really cares to cast his mind back to something which he is never going to think of without pain. Inevitable as it is that the names of persons who were dear to us and are now lost should cause us a gnawing sort of pain when we think of them, that pain is not without a pleasure of its own. As my teacher Attalus used to say, in the pleasure we find in the memory of departed friends, there is a resemblance to the way in which certain bitter fruits are agreeable, or the very acidity of an exceedingly old wine has its attraction. But after a certain interval, all that pained us is obliterated, and the enjoyment comes to us unalloyed. If we are to believe him, thinking of friends who are alive and well is like feasting on cakes and honey. Recalling those who are gone is pleasant, but not without a touch of sourness. Who would deny, though, that even acid things like this, with a harshness in their taste, do stimulate the palate? Personally, I do not agree with him there. Thinking of departed friends is to me something sweet and mellow, for when I had them with me, it was with the feeling that I was going to lose them, and now that I have lost them, I keep the feeling that I have them with me still. So, my dear Lucilius, behave in keeping with your usual fair-mindedness, and stop misinterpreting the kindness of fortune. She has given, as well as taken away. Let us therefore go all out to make the most of friends, since no one can tell how long we shall have the opportunity. Let us just think how often we leave them behind when we are setting out on some long journey or other, or how often we fail to see them when we are staying in the same area, and we shall realize that we have lost all too much time while they are still alive. Can you stand people who treat their friends with complete neglect, and then mourn them to distraction, never caring about anyone unless they have lost him? And the reason they lament them so extravagantly, then, is that they are afraid people may wonder whether they did care. They are looking for belated means of demonstrating their devotion. If we have other friends, we are hardly kind or appreciative of them, if they count for so very little when it comes to consoling us for the one we have buried. If we have no other friends, we have done ourselves a greater injury than fortune has done us. She has deprived us of a single friend, but we have deprived ourselves of every friend we have failed to make. A person, moreover, who has not been able to care about more than one friend, cannot have cared even about that one too much. Supposing someone lost his one and only shirt in a robbery, would you not think him an utter idiot if he chose to bewail his loss rather than look about him for some means of keeping out the cold and find something to put over his shoulders? You have buried someone you loved. Now look for someone to love. It is better to make good the loss of a friend than to cry over him. What I am about to go on to say is, I know, a commonplace, but I'm not going to omit it merely because everyone has said it. Even a person who has not deliberately put an end to his grief finds an end to it in the passing of time, and merely growing weary of sorrowing is quite shameful as a means of curing sorrow, in the case of an enlightened man. I should prefer to see you abandoning grief than it abandoning you. Much as you may wish to, you will not be able to keep it up for very long, so give it up as early as possible. For women, our forefathers fixed the period of mourning at a year, with the intention not that women should continue mourning as long as that, but that they should not go on any longer. For men, no period is prescribed at all, because none would be decent. Yet out of all the pathetic females you know who were only dragged away from the graveside or even torn from the body itself with the greatest of difficulty, can you show me one whose tears lasted for a whole month? Nothing makes itself unpopular quite so quickly as a person's grief. When it is fresh, it attracts people to its side, finds someone to offer it consolation. But if it is perpetuated, it becomes an object of ridicule, deservedly too, for it is either feigned or foolish. And all this comes to you from me, the very man who wept for Aeneas Serenus, that dearest of friends to me, so unrestrainedly that I must needs be included, though this is the last thing I should want, among examples of men who have been defeated by grief. Nevertheless, I condemn today the way I behaved then. I realize now that my sorrowing in the way I did was mainly due to the fact that I had never considered the possibility of his dying before me. That he was younger than I was, a good deal younger too, was all that ever occurred to me, as if fate paid any regard to seniority. So let us bear it constantly in mind that those we are fond of are just as liable to death as we are ourselves. What I should have said before was, my friend Serenus is younger than I am, but what difference does that make? He should die later than me, but it is quite possible he will die before me. It was just because I did not do so that fortune caught me unprepared with that sudden blow. Now I bear it in mind not only that all things are liable to death, but that that liability is governed by no set rules. Whatever can happen at any time can happen today. Let us reflect, then, my dearest Lucilius, that we ourselves shall not be long in reaching the place we mourn his having reached. Perhaps, too, if only there is truth in the story told by sages, and some welcoming abode awaits us, he who is supposed to be dead and gone has merely been sent on ahead. Letter number 65. I shared yesterday with a bout of illness. It claimed the morning, but it let me have the afternoon, so I started off by doing some reading to see what energy I had. Then, as it proved up to this, I ventured to make further demands on it, or perhaps I should say concessions to it, and did some writing. I was at this with more than my customary concentration, too, what with the difficulty of the subject and my refusal to give in, until some friends of mine put a stop to it, applying force to restrain me, as if I were an invalid who was recklessly overdoing things. The pen gave place to talk, which included the following matter of dispute that I shall now state to you. We have appointed you as arbitrator, and you have more of a case on your hands than you think, for the contest is a three-cornered one. Our Stoic philosophers, as you know, maintain that there are two elements in the universe from which all things are derived, namely cause and matter. Matter lies inert and inactive, a substance with unlimited potential, but destined to remain idle if no one sets it in motion. And it is cause, this meaning the same as reason, which turns matter to whatever end it wishes, and fashions it into a variety of different products. There must then be something out of which things come into being, and something else by means of which things come into being. The first is matter, and the second is cause. Now all art is an imitation of nature. So apply what I was saying about the universe to man's handiwork. Take a statue. It had the matter to be worked on by the sculptor, and it had the sculptor to give configuration to the matter. Bronze, in other words, in the case of the statue, being the matter, and the craftsman the cause. It is the same with all things. They consist of something which comes into being, and something else which brings them into being. Stoics believe that there is only one cause, that which brings things into being. Aristotle thinks that the term cause can be used in three different ways. The first cause, he says, is matter. Without it, nothing can be brought into existence. The second is the craftsman, and the third is form, which is impressed on every single piece of work, as on a statue. This last is what Aristotle calls the eidos, and he says there is a fourth as well, the purpose of the whole work. Let me explain what this means. The first cause of the statue is the bronze, as it would never have been made unless there had been something out of which it could be cast and moulded. The second cause is the sculpture, as the bronze could not have been shaped into the state in which it is without those skilled hands having come to it. The third cause is the form, as our statue could not have been called the man with the spear or the boy tying up his hair had this not been the guise impressed on it. The fourth cause is the end in view in its making, for had this not existed, the statue would never have been made at all. What is this end? It is what attracted the sculptor, what his goal was in creating it. It may have been money, if when he worked it he was going to sell it, or fame, if the aim of his endeavours was to win a name, or religion, if it was a work for presentation to a temple. This, too, then, is a cause of the statue's coming into being. Unless you take the view that things in the absence of which the statue would never have been created should not be included among the causes of the particular creation. To these four causes, Plato adds a fifth in the model, what he himself calls the idea, this being what the sculptor had constantly before his eyes as he executed the intended work. It does not matter whether he has his model without, one to which he can direct his eyes, or within, conceived and set up by the artist inside his own head. God has within himself models like this, of everything in the universe, his mind embracing the designs and calculations for his projects. He is full of these images, which Plato calls ideas, eternal, immutable, ever dynamic. So though human beings may perish, humanity in itself, the pattern on which every human being is moulded, lasts on. And while human beings go through much and pass away, itself remains quite unaffected. As Plato has it, then, there are five causes: the material, the agent, the form, the model, and the end. And finally we get the result of all these. In the case of the statue, to use the example we began with, the material is the bronze, the agent is the sculptor, the form is the guise it is given, the model is what the sculptor making it copies, the end is what the maker has in view, and the final result is the statue itself. The universe as well, according to Plato, has all these elements. The maker is God, matter is the material, the form is the general character and layout of the universe as we see it. The model, naturally enough, is the pattern which God adopted for the creation of this stupendous work in all its beauty. The end is what God had in view when he created it, and that, in case you are asking what is the end God has in view, is goodness. That, at any rate, is what Plato says. What was the cause of God's creating the universe? He is good, and whoever is good can never be grudging with anything good. So he made it as good a world as it was in his power to make it. Now it is for you, as judge, to pronounce your verdict, and declare whose statement, in your opinion, seems to be not the truest, for that here is as far out of reach as truth itself, but most like the truth. This assortment of causes which Aristotle and Plato have collected together embraces either too much or too little. For if they take the view that everything in the absence of which a thing cannot be brought into being is a cause of its creation, they have failed to name enough. They should be including time in their list of causes. Nothing can come into being without time. They should be including place. A thing will certainly not come into being if there is nowhere for this to happen. They should be including motion. Without this, nothing either comes into existence or goes out of existence. Without motion, there is no such thing as art, and no such thing as change. What we are looking for at the moment is a primary and general cause, and this must be something elementary. since matter, too, is elementary. If we ask what cause is, surely the answer is creative reason, that is to say, God. All those things which you have listed are not an array of individual causes, but dependent on a single one, the cause that actually creates. You may say form is a cause, but form is something which the artist imposes on his work. A part of the cause, yes, but not a cause. The model, too, is an indispensable instrument of the cause, but not a cause. To the sculptor, his model is as indispensable as his chisel or his file. His art can get nowhere without them, but this does not make them parts or causes of the art. The end, the artist has in view, our friend says, the thing which induces him to set about a work of creation, is a cause. Even if we grant that it is only an accessory cause, not the effective cause. Accessory causes are infinite in number. What we are after is the general cause. In any event, that assertion on the part of Plato and Aristotle that the universe in its entirety, the whole, completed work of creation, is a cause, is not in keeping with their usual acuteness as thinkers. There is a very great difference between a creation and its cause. Now, you must either pronounce your verdict, or, the easier course in matters of this nature, declare your inability to arrive at one, and order a rehearing. What pleasure, you may say, do you get out of frittering time away discussing those questions? It's not as if you could say they rid you of any emotion or drive out any desire. Well, in raising and arguing these less deserving topics, my own attitude is that they serve to calm the spirit, and that whilst I examine myself first, certainly, I examine the universe around me afterwards. I'm not even wasting time, as you suppose, at the moment, for those questions, provided they are not subjected to a mincing or dissection, with the useless kind of over-subtlety we have just seen as a result, all elevate and lighten the spirit, the soul, which yearns to win free of the heavy load it is saddled with here, and return to the world where it once belonged. For to it this body of ours is a burden and a torment. And harassed by the body's overwhelming weight, the soul is in captivity unless philosophy comes to its rescue, bidding it breathe more freely in the contemplation of nature, releasing it from earthly into heavenly surroundings. This to the soul means freedom.